This is Law and Disorder.
As part of our ongoing series, Lawyers You'll Like, we'll interview Jim Lafferty, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild in Los Angeles.
From fighting racial discrimination in the 50s to the anti-war movements, 60s, 70s, 90s, and now. We'll follow Jim Lafferty through his career.
We'll hear updates on some recent wiretapping lawsuits against the government.
Under Bush, the government claims the right to know everything about you, and you have the right to know nothing about your government.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
As part of our series, Lawyers You'll Like, we bring to you interviews with attorneys that we respect and admire for their political advocacy and the social justice issues that they pursue through their work.
I'd like to introduce attorney Jim Lafferty to our listeners. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Hey, Mike. Good morning.
Good morning.
Jim, by way of introduction and by way of full disclosure, I've known you for almost 45 years.
Indeed.
We go all the way back to Detroit. Biographically, listeners should know that you went to University of Michigan in the 50s and then Wayne State University Law School. You were working for the first racially integrated law firm in the country,
yes.
The Goodman Crockett firm. We're going to want to talk to you about that.
Mm-hmm.
You went down south during the Civil Rights Movement in the early 60s as part of the Lawyers Guild effort. You were the head of the National Lawyers Guild some 40-some years ago. And you are now, to bring things up to date, the head of the Lawyers Guild chapter in Los Angeles.
Well, I finally reached my level of competence, you see. Having been the national director, I'm now a local director of a chapter, finally settling into where I belong.
And we have to give you credit for inspiring us to put on Law and Disorder because you're the host of the Lawyers Guild show in Los Angeles. You were also a founder of one of the main chapters of the American Civil Liberties Union in Michigan. You were one of the leaders of the anti-Vietnam War movement in the 60s and early 70s. You were one of the heads of the Center for Seafarers' Rights here in New York City. You've been around for the better part of five decades causing trouble. Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, well, I'm tired. I'm going home after that introduction.
But what I'd like you to tell us is how you came to work for the Goodman Crockett firm, what kind of firm that was, and what brought you there.
Yeah, you know, that is actually kind of an interesting story. I don't think about myself all that often. My wife and I at the time had befriended a woman who divorced, she was white, she divorced a white fellow, married an African-American surgeon, and the woman's mother then and former husband moved to take away the child, didn't thinking the child should be raised in a biracial home.
The woman, what year was this?
This was 1958.
In what city?
Detroit, Michigan, yeah. It later went on to become a movie called One Potato, Two Potato. And so this woman needed a lawyer. And so I asked my law school professor, the one African-American law school professor we have, who would take this case. And he said, you need George Crockett. George Crockett being the African-American lawyer who had integrated the firm that you mentioned of Goodman, Crockett, Eden, Robb, and Philo. Went there. George agreed to take the case. The case ultimately was lost all the way through the Michigan Supreme Court, in the course of which I had researched every child custody case that ever had been decided by the court. there was absolutely no basis, of course, except race, for denying this woman her child after she had married an African-American man. But nevertheless, that's what the courts ruled, including the Michigan Supreme Court. She did lose custody of the child and eventually, by the way, committed suicide.
And that was your introduction to the Goodman
Crockett It was, and then
firm.
they hired me as a law clerk, yeah.
and listeners should know that was the main firm in Michigan. It had been founded with the rise of the United Automobile Workers and the rise of the CIO. Maurice Sugar, who was the attorney for the automobile workers, was the founder of that firm. And it was the great civil rights, civil liberties firm in the country. And working from them, because they had a connection with the Lawyers Guild, they were really like the leaders of the Lawyers Guild at
the
time.
They were founding members. Founding members. Yeah, Ernie Goodman was a founding member.
And that got you the nod to become the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. You had the job that Heidi Boghossian has now.
That's right. That's right.
I survived.
And survived. Well, you know, and therefore I understand what Heidi's going through today. It's not an easy job. It's a wonderful organization, but a tough job. You can imagine being the head of an organization of lawyers and law students and legal workers. What could be a bigger nightmare anyway, even if they're wonderful people? And so that's what she's doing. And that's what we did. Those were wonderful years, though, in the Guild. We didn't have time to be fighting with each other because you had the civil rights movement in the South.
And you went down
south. Oh,
yes.
And we set up an office in the South, and we took depositions in the South. We defended, of course. That's, I think, one of the proudest chapters in the National Lawyers Guild's history, that answering of the call of principally a white organization, the Lawyers Guild, going down into the South where there were only two lawyers in Mississippi and Alabama between them who would take these cases. Heidi's raising her hand. This is wonderful.
Oh, that's
this
what we like, do here.
Oh, do we? Oh, is it one finger or two?
That's what I do when I want to talk.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
I just wanted to ask if you could explain Arthur Conoy's role and explain who he is for listeners.
Arthur Conoy, also one of the early members of the Guild. I'm not sure a founding member, but one of the very early members, went on to become a very famous law professor at Rutgers. He always tells the great story about how in 1963 convention of the Guild, he gets a phone call from Len Holt, one of these two lawyers in the South handling these cases. Arthur says to him, "Len, where are you?" And Len says, "That question is, Arthur, where are you and why aren't you down here in Mississippi with me?" And he came back into the convention, proposed to the National Lawyers Guild convention on the spot that we scrap everything else we were doing, forget the agenda. The civil rights movement in the South is calling, and we need to answer that call. And I'm proud to say we did.
Tell us about why you became a lawyer.
Well, that's a very unromantic story. I never could stop talking in school. And my mother spent more time in school, I think, than I did, because I was constantly being, you know, thrown out of school. I had a teacher I much loved who looked at me one day and said, "Jimmy, you should be a lawyer when you grow up. You have a good gift for gab." And she was trying to silence me at the time. And no one in my family had ever gone to school or college or anything. And that was the first time anybody ever said anything halfway encouraging. So I thought, well, all right. I'm not sure what a lawyer is, but I guess so. And then I think, to be a little more serious about it, I think partly having to do with stories around my own family and upbringing, a certain sense of a keen awareness of injustice I had a clear sense of injustice. It bothered me, whether it was visited upon me or anyone else. So at an early age, I think because of that, I transferred that hope happily in a good direction.
And Jim, seems pretty immediately in the direction of racial justice.
Yeah. Racial justice, religion. It was very funny. I was the only non-Jewish kid in my neighborhood. And then a few African-American kids began to move in. So it was a changing neighborhood. And you could see right away the problems that were developing in Detroit. And yet somehow we all got along well. But then you'd go to school or you'd go somewhere else and you'd see one of these kids ill-treated. And these were your buddies. And so that sense of injustice that snapped in. And
Jim, the political movement in the 50s and the 60s for us kind of spilled over and extended itself from, but it continued with the civil rights movement, but then also got involved in opposing America's imperialist war in Vietnam. You played a role in that. Could you share some of your memories of the anti-war movement then and what lessons you think it has for us now?
Sure. Without getting into a long history of the movement then, there were divisions in it then, as there are now. There were those who wanted one set of demands, those who wanted another. There were those who had one idea about who should be allowed in a coalition and who should not. But as that movement began to grow, it began to be so big that no one could really prevent it from becoming the mass movement if only they would organize it. And so you had the perspective of people, largely in left parties. I mean, I've often said when I talk on this subject that had it not been for the Socialist Workers' Party, had it not been for the Communist Party USA, I'm not sure the anti-war movements would have been nearly as successful as the anti-Vietnam War movement was. It takes people who have that kind of an organizational background to pull together diverse forces, after all. I mean, there's no standing anti-war movement the way there is a standing army. Somebody has to organize it. Somebody has to have that initial vision. Somebody has to have the political ideology that can see where the country is going to understand the imperialist nature of that war. And that was the various left parties. And they helped pull together these broad coalitions that then became coalitions of everyone from virtually every walk of life. The National Peace Action Coalition, which was one of the two major coalitions that I and others helped found, had on its board of directors or its steering committee retired admirals and generals before we were done, as well as leftists and anarchists and religionists and students and labor leaders and so forth. What we learned then, of course, was the same lesson that constantly has to be retaught, sadly, is that when the U.S. government is engaged in an effort to expand its imperial empire, you aren't going to be able to stop that by electing somebody who is a little less imperialistic, somebody who is a little more willing to talk about peace, someone who's a little less quick to pull the trigger. You're only going to force that Congress to get out of Vietnam or now to get out of Iraq if you have such a mass movement from the population itself that it leaves that Congress, be it Republican or Democrat, no choice. I mean, we tend to forget, for example, that we got out of Vietnam under Nixon and Ford. These were hardly men of peace. But by that time, because of the anti-war movement, both within the armed services itself that people like you, Mike, and others helped build within the services itself, the massive protests of people in the streets of America, it became impossible for anyone, including a Republican Congress or Republican presidents, to continue the war anymore. That, of course, coupled with the victories on the battlefield of the Vietnamese. Well, translate that today. Today you have a civil war. You have the clear unwillingness of the people of Iraq to have us in their country. You have the disintegration going on within the armed services. You have the inability of the armed services to even fill its ranks, even with $40,000 bonuses, because nobody wants to be the last one to die in a pointless, wrong, horrific war. And you have millions of people. And by the way, one of the things that irritates me is people often say, where's the anti-war movement today? Where's the anti-war movement today? It took 20,000 body bags during Vietnam before a majority of the American people were opposed to the war in Vietnam. And it took more years of fighting and dying in Vietnam before you could get hundreds of thousands of people in the streets the way we've already done in this country today. The Vietnam syndrome is alive and well in many ways. And the anti-war movement today, for all of its problems, is way ahead even of where it was then. And it was a brilliant, wonderful, successful movement then, and it can be again today.
Tell us about your work helping to found the National Peace Action Coalition.
Well, we founded it because by that time the existing coalition was drifting away somewhat from street demonstrations and was also becoming multi-issue. That is to say, it was taking up not only issues of the war, but the 30-hour work week and many other worthy causes, domestic issues as well. We felt, those of us who formed the National Peace Action Coalition, that the most effective way to build a movement against the war was to require people, if they were going to join it, to only have to agree on the issue of the war. Oh, at our demonstrations, we might talk about civil rights and gay rights and the environment and 30-hour work weeks, but you didn't have to sign on to that program in order to be part of the anti-war movement if you were part of the National Peace Action Coalition. And the proof is sort of in the pudding. Our sister coalition would hold a demonstration, and it might have 100,000 or 150,000 people, and we would hold a demonstration, and there'd be several hundred thousand people. It was easier to get people to come together if all they had to do was agree on that one central issue. And then we simply, working through the campuses, as people do today, extended an invitation to everyone to join, and there was no hurdle to joining. If you were opposed to the war, we were the place to come to.
Jim, an important theme that has pervaded not only the Guild's history, but the history of this country has been government overreaching. Mm-hmm. One court case that comes to mind is U.S. District Court, the Nixon wiretapping.
Oh, the Nixon wiretapping
yeah.
case.
Okay. Arthur Conoy argued that case, and I believe one of the justices really chastised the government, the Nixon administration at that time, for intimidating anyone who criticized the government mm-hmm. and really operating their own system of separate system of justice. How does that relate to where we are today with eavesdropping? Do you see things as parallel to 40 years ago, or are they worse?
Oh, I think they're much worse. And people even older than me who were victimized. I mean, I was ultimately subpoenaed before the House Un-American Activities Committee, but that was near the end of its reign, and we organized a defense committee, and they ultimately backed down. To go back to this for a minute, but if you talk to people who are 80 years old, who truly, you know, the Doris Brin Walkers, one of the early presidents of the National Lawyers, folks like that, if you talk to Vic Rabinowitz today, if you talk to any of those folks, all of them say to me, Ann Ginger, another great historian of the Lawyers Guild, it's much worse today. We've got COINTELPRO today. We've got all of the same kinds of stuff we had during the 60s and 70s and 50s. But more so, the president, George Bush, just signed an executive order which puts in danger the property and liberty of the anti-war movement in this country today, not simply through infiltration as we had to deal with during Vietnam, but the actual loss of property, the actual loss of your freedom in a much more direct way, and all without the benefit of the kind of court protection that we could look to then. I always hate to say this because it may discourage young lawyers, but I think the period ahead, to the extent that we expect success in the period ahead in the courts, I think we're largely kidding ourselves. I think we're going to have to rely on ourselves a lot more than we rely on the courts. I think
the movement always, in the streets.
The movement
in
the
words.
Streets. Yeah. Somebody asked me the other day, what do I think is the most effective way to stand up to the repression in this country today? To call it what it is, to stand up on a public street corner and say, I'm not going to take repression, to speak out against it. I mean, I think that is literally more effective than anything else you can do. If we won't be cowed by it, we won't need to worry about going to court over it. Now, we still need great lawyers that we have in the guild to be doing that, to carry on that fight in the court, to win what we can win in the courts. But if we leave it to the lawyers, we're doomed. I really believe that.
Jim, let me ask you this in terms of how you make social change in this country, because we have our own experience from the 60s, and we have experience of the generation before us in the 30s, mm-hmm. And now we see younger people trying to cope with the question I'm going to ask you. And that's, how do you make social change in this country? Do you do it through the Democratic Party? Do you do it in the streets? Do you do it through your own organization? I mean, how is your thinking involved on this? Because I remember when I first met you back in Detroit in 1967, you were a Democratic Party candidate for Congress mm-hmm. against the war, but nonetheless in the Democratic Party. And I know today you wouldn't walk across the street to vote for him.
No.
So what's your thinking in terms of how one makes social change most effectively in this country? Yeah. You know, where should the movement go?
Yeah. Forgive me my past sins, you know, of having run as a Democratic Party candidate. I was young. No, seriously, I don't know. I'm not enough of a historian. There may have been a time in this country where it made some sense to vote for a Roosevelt as opposed to somebody else. I'm not sure about that even.
Or Lincoln.
Yeah, well, he was a Republican, yes. But it certainly makes no sense today. I mean, with the role that corporate money plays, with the role of the corporate media, you know, the differences between the Democrats and Republicans today, yes, of course there are differences. The point is they aren't substantial enough to alter the downward slide of the country into the great abyss. The analogy I sometimes use is I imagine there are two boats out on a lake. One's the Republican Party boat, one's the Democratic Party boat. They both have holes in them. I'll grant you that. I'll even grant you there are more holes in the Republican Party boat than there are in the Democrat. Stay in either one of those boats, though, and what happens? You drowned. I mean, question is, do you want to drown quicker or slower? I mean, I'd rather try to swim to the other shore in a new direction. Forget either one of those parties. They aren't going to save the day for us. And it's sad. Every time an election year comes around, the anti-war movement always takes it on the chin because people who have otherwise been organizing demonstrations in the streets, which, as I say, is the only way you can possibly make any kinds of change in this country, suddenly find themselves wanting to try to elect Kucinich. Wanting to elect Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. Barack Obama, who, by the way, just last week talked about wanting to go and bomb Pakistan, for God's sakes. And Hillary Clinton saying to NPR a couple of weeks ago, she expected there would be troops in Iraq at the end of her second term of office. Say nothing of the hubris of that comment. I mean, it also tells you where she's coming from in terms of where it comes to matters like war and peace or global warming, the things that really affect our future. You can't expect any capitalist politician who only gets to be in office anyway with the help of corporate America to be different enough from one another to save the day. All they can offer is a slower death, slower, global warming, redeployed troops that are killing people in Pakistan as opposed to in Iraq. To me, that's no answer at all.
What do you tell people who go out in the streets and demonstrate what they should do the next day when they come home?
Talk with their neighbors. They should organize town halls. They should organize meetings. They should have petition drives. They should be holding mock impeachment trials and planning the next demonstration. In 1971, Mike knows this story, so I apologize. In 1971, I had the honor of meeting Phan Van Dong in Hanoi.
Phan Van Dong was
the prime minister of North Vietnam during the war.
During the war?
During the war.
So you're meeting with the prime minister of an enemy country.
Yes.
While the bombs are falling.
Yes.
What happened?
Charming man, by the way. Just lovely, lovely man. One of the people with us, as a matter of fact, had been an ex-pilot, U.S. pilot. And when we were meeting there, about six or eight of us meeting with him, and he didn't live in Ho's old palace, but he came and met people there. The pilot started to cry. And when he was introduced, saying, you know, this is the first time I've actually been on the ground in your country, but I flew over your country some years ago and dropped bombs on it. Phan Van Dong got up, tears streaming down his face, grabbed some flowers out of a flower vase in the middle of the table, ran over and handed these flowers to this ex-pilot and gave him a big hug and said, you come back in peace. And that's what really matters, you see. No, so I said to Phan Van Dong, I said, I'm amazed. Everywhere I go in this country, there's complete confidence that this poor little bedraggled country with hardly a light bulb burning at night is going to defeat the most powerful military force the world's ever seen. Where does that come from? He says, the American people have no sense of history. The American people have no sense of history. And what he meant by that was, of course, they'd been fighting for 1,000 years for their freedom. Well, that's another 10, 15, 20, 30 years. The U.S. at that point had been fighting, you know, 6 or 8 years. They were getting tired, and they would get tired because it wasn't their land. It wasn't their freedom. In the final analysis, it didn't matter to the people of the United States. It only mattered to those who were running the United States, who wanted to make sure they could have a base in the Far East and part of the Pacific Rim and the tin and the tungsten and all the rest. The same thing that drives us now is the oil, of course, in Iraq. In this country, somebody has a demonstration one day, and they don't understand why the war hasn't stopped. It takes a while to build that kind of a movement. The civil rights movement didn't succeed overnight. The women's movement didn't make progress overnight. The anti-war movement will take some time, too, and it's making progress, yeah.
Jim, what advice do you give to young activists who see the increasing repression of law enforcement all around the country on various levels when people do take to the streets? So one may expect there's a good chance of either being arrested or hurt. What do you tell young people?
Well, I tell them to be cautious, of course, to watch what they say on telephones when they're planning their events, to try to go out in as strong in numbers as they can, to try to involve in their struggle those who might be harder for the police to crack down and repress. But mainly what I tell them is you have a choice. You can either take that risk now in a thoughtful way, or you can end up losing your voice and losing your right and end up not being a free person. I mean, the choice is yours. If you want to be free, if you really want to advance the things you say are dear to your heart, you have no choice but to act. Act smart, act prudently, but act. Don't be afraid.
We are seeing an increasing number of political activists being subpoenaed to appear before grand juries, and we never quite heard that story from you about when you were subpoenaed. What advice do you give?
I'll tell you what we did when they subpoenaed about 10 or 12 of us. We were the heads of the two major anti-war coalitions at the time. The first thing we did was
Who subpoenaed you. This was not a grand jury.
The House Un-American Activities Committee. Yeah, because of quote unquote communist influence And so we reserved for a couple of weeks hence the press club in Washington, D.C. And then we put together a massive defense committee within a couple of weeks. And we got entertainers and writers and scholars, and I don't think there were any members of Congress who would stand with us at that point. And we had a press conference. And we simply said the House Un-American Activities Committee is full of you-know-what. It has no right to be subpoenaing us. It has no right to be asking these questions. We're very open about our movement. Yes, there are communists in our movement. There are communist religionists, trade unions. Everybody's welcome in our movement. This is America. And the only thing they're afraid of is that this movement is going to succeed, and it's going to succeed in keeping this this government from, you know, from its imperial designs in Vietnam, and that's why they're doing it. And we're not going to say anything to them. We're not going to give them any information at all. And they called one witness. The first witness they called was Fred Halstead at the, from the Socialist Workers Party. By this time, we had done more than this one press conference. We had signed petitions. We were getting people signing things. And the first question they asked Fred was something about, do you have the key to the Coke machine or something? It was some really bizarre, lame question. He said, yeah, I have the key to the Coke machine. And they said, okay. And that was the end of the hearing, literally. I mean, they asked him like two questions like that. And we went home. They had backed down at this point. They understood they weren't going to get anywhere. And there'd been such a well-organized defense committee formed around this. And it was, as I say, in the weakened later stages of the House Un-American Activities Committee, that it was sort of their last gasp and their last hurrah, if you will.
Looking back on your legal career, can you share with us some of the highlights?
Well, you know, the reason I'm laughing is because
I think you're going to tell the story about when you quit practicing law.
That was the highlight of my legal career. Actually, no, it's true. I should say
your career as a lawyer. This series is about lawyers you'll like.
Yes. And well, I hope you'll like.
Yeah, yeah, and we do. That's why we have you on.
No, I know. I mean, there were cases, you know, like the Dan Rutt case, for example, that was another example of this was during the when the Soviet Union went into Afghanistan and then had to learn its lesson in Afghanistan. Carter, you remember, at the time, reinstituted draft registration. And 22 men in this country refused to register publicly. That is to say, they held press conferences and said, we won't register. Those 22 men were indicted. The other hundreds of thousands who just didn't bother to register, of course, weren't. And one of those men was in Michigan. That was Dan Rutt, and I represented him. And it was a wonderful example of how you could, because at the end of the day, he tried his own case. I mean, all the pretrial motions, and we had a room full of pretrial motions, went on for months. But when it finally came time after we'd lost all those motions, he actually tried his own case in front of the jury. He lost. But the press was sympathetic. There were huge demonstrations outside the courtroom. He was able to make his points about the nature of the draft and the nature of U.S. foreign policy. The Supreme Court ultimately ruled against us on all the cases. Bill Smith from Los Angeles and other lawyers took those cases all the way up to the Supreme Court, as did I. But we lost. But the broader political issue was won, I think. And one of the other lessons, by the way, that resonated loud and clear across the country was, if you don't hold a press conference and say you're not going to register, you cannot register and get away with it. Indeed, there are millions of unregistered young men in this country today who, despite the penalties of $25,000 in prison time, are in a sense immune because nobody's prosecuting you if you don't say anything about it.
Jim, what you're speaking above reminds me of a wonderful book by Guild member Jules Obel entitled Success Without Victory. He talks about the importance of bringing these causes into the public fore through litigation, through what we call people's lawyering. And you are a people's lawyer.
Yeah.
So I think that to those of us who respect you dearly, I would answer Dahlia's question that the whole body of your work, from litigation as a lawyer to public arena work, protest and defense of protesters, really sends the message that it's not whether we win or lose in court, it's that we bring the issue into the public conscience.
Exactly. No, that's well put. And the kinds of cases that the Lafferty, Riasty, and Smith and I, that law firm that Mike and I were in back in Detroit, there's a Detroit police file on that firm, and it says that there wasn't a single member of the Black Liberation Movement or the gay movement or the anti-war movement or the civil rights movement or what, I forget all that they named, that hasn't at one time or another been represented by, and then they named our law firm. Well, it's something we were very proud of.
And they listed you as your MO, your method of operation?
Yeah.
Jim Lafferty's MO? Attorney.
Attorney, yeah, that's right, which I thought was very accurate. But We probably lost as many of those, not the draft cases, but a lot of those kinds of cases. Never lost a draft case. We represented, for example, a lot of the Black nationalist cases, and we lost those cases, generally speaking. But the press that they got, the way that helped build a movement in Detroit, as you say, advanced those cases far more in many ways than a quiet court victory ever could have.
Well, Jim Lafferty, head of the National Lawyers Guild out in Los Angeles, guest of the Lawyers Guild show in L.A., the founding spirit of our program, longtime movement activist. It's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. Good luck to you, and go out and make some trouble.
I will do that. Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank
Jim.
You all.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In the wake of Congress approving a dramatic expansion of U.S. warrantless wiretapping powers, the Center for Constitutional Rights has argued that the NSA's program is unconstitutional and should be struck down. The argument in the case called CCR v. Bush comes after Congress and the Bush administration passed the Protect America Act of 2007, which broadly expands the government's power to spy on Americans without getting court approval. The law effectively removes oversight from spying from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court, or FISA Court, and leaves it up to the executive branch to monitor itself, with Attorney General Gonzalez having the primary responsibility for oversight. Today, we'll talk with Shane Cadedil of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Welcome, Shane, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's been nearly a year since you were last on with Michael Avery, who's also working on this case. You were recently in court in San Francisco on the NSA domestic spying program. Can you give us an update of what happened in the courtroom?
Sure. Well, you know, initially we had expected to really just reprise our oral argument that took place in New York in September 2006, you know, which was, you know, basically... we were coming in arguing that the government had already admitted enough about the NSA program that we could prove it was illegal without getting any more facts. And the government was saying, no, that's not true. You need to bring in more facts, and since those facts are the highest level of state secret, can't litigate this case, and the court has to dismiss it. Well, you know, we, unfortunately, between now and then, the judicial panel on multi-district litigation transferred our case to be in San Francisco, where dozens of other cases where people were suing telephone companies for their participation in the NSA program were already sort of pending. And the point, I guess, was that, you know, it was somehow more efficient for one court to hear all of these cases.
Well, Shane, let me just stop you for a second. What is the interest of the Center for Constitutional Rights in this? Do you think that the government was spying on the center, or is it just a broader interest in protecting the rights of Americans, or is it both?
Oh, well, it's a little bit of both, but, I mean, it's primarily the first, the interest of the center. You know, when the program was sort of announced, were admitted to by the president after the New York Times broke the story in December 2005, you know, what they said was that we're listening to people, you know, where one end of the call is outside of the United States and one end is inside, and we think someone on the line is a member of Al-Qaeda or an affiliated organization or just generally linked to terrorism somehow. And we thought, well, that basically describes all of our clients. You know, for instance, we represent Meher Arar, a Canadian citizen who was stopped at JFK Airport while he was flying home to Canada, questioned by the U.S. for 12 days and then sent to Syria to be tortured for almost a year.
You're part of a large law office staff in New York, and the government is listening in to your conversations with your clients.
Right. I mean, we think, for instance, you know, a call to Meher Arar to discuss his civil case against the U.S. government, that's exactly the kind of thing they think they could listen to under the NSA program. It makes it very difficult for us to challenge other illegal conduct of this administration through litigation.
Shane, well, wasn't that a difficult part of your argument in New York, the so-called standing issue, where you had to prove, and where it's nearly impossible to prove, that you suspect your conversations and emails may have been monitored?
Right, right. Well, we think that, you know, we are likely targets. Of course, it's a secret surveillance program, and we don't have any direct documentary evidence that that our calls and emails were surveilled. Our standing is based on a kind of chilling effect theory, which is something that courts have recognized in lots of other contexts, which is basically, you know, because we're attorneys and because, you know, we have an ethical obligation as attorneys to preserve the confidentiality of our communications with our clients and witnesses and other people involved with these cases, well, you know, that means that we have to take countermeasures because of the existence of the NSA program. So we just can't pick up the phone and call Meher Arar in Canada about any old issue related to his case. There may be situations where you have to go fly there and meet him, or we may have to use other communications methods.
And we should just say parenthetically that Meher Arar was acquitted by a commission of the Canadian government, awarded many millions of dollars, and apologized to, something the United States refused to do.
Right, right. A $12 million settlement after a year and a half inquest basically showed that he had absolutely not even a shred of evidence that would lead them to suspect him of any involvement.
Let me ask you to state for the audience what it is that the government is claiming they've got the right to do to people and to attorneys and with phone companies.
The part of the NSA program that they admitted to is basically this notion that if one end of the call is outside the U.S. and one end is inside, and they think that somebody on the line is you know, associated with terrorism somehow, that they can listen to that call without ever going through the process that Congress created by statute in the wake of the Watergate era. The statute is called FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, and it basically says you have to go to a court and you have to bring evidence that shows a probable cause that someone's an agent of a foreign power. Can mean anything. It can mean, you know, that they're associated with a foreign government, a foreign political party, a foreign terrorist group, you know, you name it. So pretty easy standard for the government to meet. There have only been 5 FISA warrants rejected out of the first 19,000 applications to the court.
And even then, FISA was too restrictive for them. 5 out of 19,000, and they couldn't live with it.
Right, right.
They couldn't live with a rubber stamp.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the things that makes us very suspicious, that the real reason that they wanted to go around FISA with this program was primarily because they want to listen to the sort of calls that FISA judges would never let them monitor.
And what sort of calls are those, Shane?
Sure, you know, calls of journalists with their sources, calls of attorneys with their clients. You know, but there's also probably, you know, a much larger component to it, which the New York Times didn't talk about and the president didn't admit to, but, you know, something much closer to this total information awareness kind of program where, you know, they use, you know, computers to do some level of monitoring of almost every communication. You know, so you could easily scan 99% of emails, you know, going through, you know, the U.S. network, telecommunications networks, and try to find, you know, pick out all the ones that have some combination of 4 words in them that is, you know, thought to be sort of, you know, suspicious, you know, and then have humans filter through the actual messages. And that kind of thing may be going on, and that's what's referred to as data mining.
Shane, your argument in CCR v. Bush, which is the official name of the case, came just days after Congress and the Bush administration passed the Protection America Act of 2007. Now, that expands the government's power to spy on Americans without court approval. Can you explain that a bit? It's due to expire in 6 months, I understand?
Mm-hmm. That's right. It's a sunsetting statute, which means it has an automatic expiry date. And that was one of the things, I think, that made it easy for a Democratic Congress to rationalize passing it. There's a little bit of backstory here that goes back really to about New Year's Day this year. The ACLU brought a parallel case on the same day that we did, and their case was up on appeal in January. I mean, the government didn't want a bad ruling from a court of appeals. So what they did is they went to the FISA court in January, apparently. They got one FISA judge to approve of some sort of wholesale program of surveillance, and we don't know the exact details because FISA court orders are always secret, and even Congress hasn't seen these. But they got somebody to approve, one of the 11 judges on the court, to approve of something very similar to the NSA program. And then they said, well, look, all your cases are moot because now we have the approval that under FISA that you were complaining that we didn't get in the first place. Now, we always suspected that those FISA orders from January were actually illegal, that they were way past what the judge was authorized to allow under the statute. And it seems like that was the case, because what happened apparently is in April and May, other judges, different FISA court judges, had to do sort of an ongoing 90-day review of the initial orders. And they said, these are ridiculous, and they negated them. They wouldn't renew them. Now, the government made a big deal out of the initial orders. They came into court and filed papers saying, your case is moot now, you have to throw this out because we went ahead and got FISA court approval. What they did when the orders came out reversing that January decision was they filed completely secret documents without even a summary in all of these cases in April. Because of that reversal in April and May, the Director of National Intelligence went to Congress and said, look, now we can't really do the NSA program, because of this reversal. And so, we need you to give us, explicit authority to go ahead and do it, which is something they never asked the Republican Congress for 5 years that they were doing the NSA program before. Bush never went to them and said, let's, give me authority to do data mining, give me authority to do this sort of surveillance of one-end foreign calls. But all of a sudden, about 2 weeks or so before the session ended, the DNI and other folks from the administration started really pressuring Congress to pass something, and they were using all sorts of ridiculous rhetoric. You can't go on vacation and let the nation be vulnerable to attack. Better hope that nothing happens in the next couple of weeks while you guys are out of session if you don't pass this. Congress caved in, basically, and what they did with this Protect America Act is basically allow wholesale collection of calls and emails as long as the target person is outside of the United States. So, a U.S. citizen who's outside of the U.S. who's calling in to the United States or being called by someone in the U.S., that phone call is something that they can listen to without really any restrictions as long as they're intending to target the person outside the U.S.
We're speaking with Shane Katedil, who is one of the star attorneys at the Center for Constitutional Rights, embattled now with the government and these Orwellian laws, really total information awareness on the part of the government and a total ignorance on the part of the people of what the government is doing. And Shane just got through arguing a case on that point on government wiretaps. Shane, you made a point before about you think that government phone wiretaps are just the tip of the iceberg. I know that there was a Pentagon program called DARPA. It was the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. They have an internet site, and on the site, they indicated that the electronic data that they gather are, and this is a quote, and I want you to comment on this. This is what they gather: financial, educational, travel, medical, veterinary, county entry, place event entry, transportation, housing, critical resources, government communications. They're gathering all that kind of data, and then they cross-reference this stuff with biometric signatures of humans, data collected on individuals' faces, fingerprints, gaits, and irises. And then with this knowledge, I think that the government has this at their fingertips, and then they would have what we call total information awareness. And this is what you're grappling, because you're talking about one piece of this whole Orwellian picture when you went to court the other day to argue about the illegal tappings of the phones.
Right. DARPA is the agency, actually, that I guess created the internet, so we should give them some credit for something. But they're also sort of the agency that does like all these sort of experimental kind of intelligence programs, including kind of total information awareness. What all that really gets to is the sort of long-term dream of intelligence agencies, which is to replace the sort of fallible human element in intelligence collection, intelligence agents, you know, who are notoriously flaky and can be converted to be double agents by the other side and are expensive and, you know, somewhat unreliable, to replace them with a kind of mechanized way of identifying suspects, of identifying targets for surveillance and, you know, people who may be up to no good. And so, you know, the way that would work in this sort of long-term, you know, dream of mechanized intelligence is that you collect a huge amount of information and then you come up with very detailed profiles for the sort of things that terrorists would do. So maybe, you know, look at the 9/11 guys. They grew up in some conservative, you know, sort of, you know, Muslim country with a dictatorial government, but, you know, they dress sort of very modern and they use cash to go on one-way flights, you know, at odd times during the week, and they have a certain travel pattern and a certain pattern of making calls overseas. And if you can plug in enough of that information, you know, the dream of, you know, these folks at DARPA who are trying to develop these things is that somehow you can come up with a reliable means of identifying who's going to be a terrorist just by all this sort of abstract information without ever having a tipster or an informer or people infiltrating, you know, sort of terrorist groups, that sort of thing. You can do it all without throwing up a huge number of false positives. That's their goal in collecting this, you know, vast, vast array of information. But, of course, it's also subject to, you know, a vast, vast amount of, you know, abuse, especially if it's directed at, you know, political opponents.
I would also argue that ultimately what they're doing is directed at American citizens. Wouldn't you agree?
There's any distinction, right? I mean, kind of interesting is to compare the experience in England, where the major, you know, sort of terrorist acts and the suspects are primarily English citizens and they're second generation, you know, immigrants. There, it's sort of a homegrown problem. Here in the U.S., you know, I feel like our government has been very careful to constantly portray things as being, you know, sort of a foreign other who's doing this to us. You know,
my thought was, though, that it was aimed at American citizens, because with all this information, they're in a position to thwart any kind of movement for social justice.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the history of, you know, warrantless surveillance in general has been that it has always been turned against political opponents of the regimes. You know, the NAACP submitted a great amicus brief written by John Hafitz of the Brenner Center, in our case, talking about how, you know, for 25 years the organization was under surveillance because of, you know, suspected communist links. And that, you know, basically it was used to, you know, warrantless surveillance was used to investigate and discredit the civil rights movement. And the same thing happened with the anti-war movement, you know, and it was Republican and Democratic presidents, Johnson and Nixon and Eisenhower, presumably Kennedy too, who were involved in doing this sort of stuff. So it's so amenable to abuse that it wouldn't be surprising to me if there was political abuse of it right now too. And frankly, you know, the Center for Constitutional Rights is one of those political opponents of the regime. In perfect sense that they would want to find out what we were up to and try to find ways of discrediting us by listening in on all of our calls if they could.
Shane, earlier you mentioned that there were some other cases, one being the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit that AT&T, they say, collaborated with the NSA to illegally track domestic and foreign communications. What is the status of those cases?
You know, the government made the same sort of arguments. The government intervened. The government wasn't initially a defendant. It was just a private damages action against the phone companies. But the government, you know, added itself as a party to the case and then said, look, you know, to the court, you have to dismiss this case because you just can't litigate it without, you know, getting all this sort of information that's a state secret to the case. And the court said, no, you know, that's not the case. We may be able to work with stuff that's already in the public record. And EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation, had some voluminous whistleblower documents from a technician who used to work at AT&T and was kind of appalled that they were rewiring all their circuits to send one copy of every, you know, sort of call and email, basically, onto Fort Meade, where the NSA is based. So the judge was very cautious, and he said, I'm not going to dismiss this case outright. And then the government appealed that. And so that was recently argued before the Ninth Circuit. You know, the luck of the draw, we drew a very, very liberal panel of three judges. So I think, you know, the kind of ruling that we'll get out of it, hopefully, says, you know, that this case can go forward.
I also wanted to add, Shane, that the other case that was argued last week in the Ninth Circuit was a case involving Al-Haraman Islamic Foundation. In that case, the foundation was discussing things with its attorneys. The NSA was wiretapping the discussion between the attorneys for a charity and the charity itself, and the government claimed that they had a right to do that.
Yeah, that's kind of a fascinating case because, you know, most of the challenges have been brought by folks who, you know, may have reason to think that they were, you know, surveilled, but they don't have hard documentary evidence. Now, Al-Haramain was put on a terrorist sort of organization list by OFAC, an Office of Foreign Assets Control within the Treasury Department, and you get to challenge that designation. And so an administrative proceeding, and so the agency turned over a bunch of information that they used to back up their designation as a terrorist organization, and they accidentally put this little document in there that supposedly indicates that the NSA was listening in on a phone conversation between officers and board members of the charity and the two lawyers for the charity in Washington, D.C. You know, this was accidentally turned over. The government claims it's still classified. When the Al-Haramain folks filed a copy of it with the court under seal so that the public couldn't, you know, see it, the government went to the court and said, you know, you, judge, have to turn that document over to us. Your courtroom isn't a secure enough place to hold it. It has to be put in, you know, sensitive compartmentalized information facility and so forth. The judge refused to turn it over. Eventually, a compromise was reached. Through a stroke of luck, these guys actually supposedly have information that shows that they were an actual target. So in some ways, that standing problem doesn't exist in the same way.
It's just extraordinary.
For us.
Now, Shane, you mentioned a few minutes ago that in the Electronic Frontier Foundation, they drew a rather liberal judge. Tell us about the judge who you argued before in San Francisco and compare that to what I thought seemed a really wonderfully receptive judge in New York a year ago.
Sure. Well, the EFF is on appeal, so they drew a panel of three liberal judges. But their case in the district court, the trial level court, is before the same judge that we were before, who's named Vaughn Walker. And, you know, yes, it's the same Walker as George Walker Bush. Apparently, they're distant relatives. Now, he's a Republican, but he's got a very strong libertarian streak. And so I think, in some ways, he's not a bad judge for us to be in front of. But the multi-district litigation panel transferred us from being before Judge Gerard Lynch in New York City, who's, you know, by reputation one of the smartest, you know, half-dozen judges in the federal system, a brilliant Columbia law professor before President Clinton appointed him, and politically more, you know, I suppose, thought to be more liberal. But you never know how these things are going to work out. There are going to be a lot of different judges who get a chance to rule on the validity of this program before the day is done, assuming that Congress doesn't, shoot us in the foot by passing more horrendous statutes.
And when do you expect a decision?
I think any time in the next couple months you could see something potentially at least deciding the standing issue, in our case, from the judge in San Francisco.
Shane Katedil from the Center for Constitutional Rights. If you had to sum up succinctly what's at stake here, what would you tell the audience?
Sure. It's basically about whether or not the president, the executive branch, can listen in to your private communications without having any oversight. Traditionally, we demand that that law enforcement and the intelligence agencies and the president go to judges and ask for warrants before they can listen in on your phone calls. And in order to get a warrant, they have to show some evidence, hard evidence, that actually justifies suspicion. When you let the executive just do whatever it wants without ever going through a court process, there's two things that happen. First of all, innocent people are going to get overheard, and that's a violation of their privacy rights. But the second thing I think people don't realize so much, and that's that you get less efficient law enforcement. I mean, one of the nice things about the traditional warrant process is that it forces law enforcement to focus on threats that are real, to listen in only on situations where they have some real evidence to prove something happened. And that's a real useful form of sort of accountability and oversight by the courts. In some ways, saying that we don't need courts involved in the warrant process is like me saying I don't need my boss here. If my boss wasn't looking over my shoulder all the time, I'd do a much better job just monitoring myself. And that goes against everything that our system of government is designed to ensure.
And we should remind everyone that Attorney General Gonzalez will have the primary responsibility for oversight in this. Shane, we could talk with you for hours about this. It's a subject that's near and dear to all of our hearts and so important to everyone in this country. But alas, we're running out of time, so we'll just have to look forward to another update from you in the near future.
All right. Well, my pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, on behalf of all of us, keep up the good work. We're in your corner, and we want to talk to you soon.
Bye, Shane.
Thanks, Shane.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The ideas expressed here on Law and Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.